Hey guys, welcome back. Holy hell. Let me just first apologize for publishing this a day late. Vegas got me, man. I just got in from Vegas yesterday after a fun weekend and maybe a little too much fun. So I apologize. It's Vegas, man. It's Vegas. And so this is a day late. I am so sorry, but hey, let's move on. Let's go ahead and jump into our scary tale today, because this one is creepy. It's pretty spooky. It is considered one of the best haunting stories in the United States. So let's just dive right in. When you think of witches, you think of some old nasty woman with maybe a wart on her nose. Maybe you think of, if you're old school, you think of Samantha from Bewitched. Or you think of the witch from The Wizard of Oz. Or the Sanderson sisters. Or one of my favorites, Fiona, which was Jessica Lange's character from American Horror Story, Coven. But today, we are talking about one bad witch. Though, I don't know if she was necessarily old and ugly. And she probably didn't have a wart on her nose. But maybe she did. I don't expect there was a lot of dermatologists back then. But today, we're talking about the Bell Witch. But first, why are we even calling her a witch? Well, the reason behind her name is that early settlers considered most anything that confused them or mystified them as witchery. So, like, if you were to time travel right now back to the 1800s and show them, like, your smartphone, they'd probably try to burn you at the stake. Now, also, keep in mind that the Bell Witch incidents were happening about 125 years or so after the Salem Witch Trials. And that widespread paranoia about unexplained things and behavior ran amok. The Bell Witch was the name that was given to the spirit or entity in the 1800s, and it has stuck ever since. So, the legend of the Bell Witch, no one has yet to solve it or even come close. Much of the story has no proof to it because of how long ago it was. You know, it's hard to have any evidence because of the time that has passed. But this story has it all. Spirits, poltergeist activity, apparitions with demonic undertone, and shapeshifters. So, let's go back. Let me tell you this spooky and chilling story of one of America's most documented and scary hauntings. So get that fuzzy blanket and pull it up tight to your chin. Turn down the lights, get in the mood for this creepy story. That is, if you dare. The story of the Bell Witch begins with the John Bell family of Red River, Tennessee, now Adams, Tennessee. The origin of the legendary Bell Witch is, of course, a mystery. In early accounts, the spirit herself provides its inception. She says, "I am a spirit. I once was very happy, but I have been disturbed and made unhappy. I am the spirit of a person who was buried in the woods nearby, and a grave was disturbed, my bones disinterred and scattered, and one of my teeth was lost under this house. I am here looking for that tooth." Of course, nothing can be verified of this account, but it is said that there are several Indian burial mounds that can be found in that region. In another event, the witch also says that she is a spirit from everywhere, heaven, hell, the earth. I am in the air, the houses, any place at any time, have been created millions of years. Now, I know that last sentence didn't really make a lot of sense, but I was just saying it as it was quoted, what this entity supposedly actually said. So I'm not sure why she said it like that or why it was documented like that. But those were the words. I didn't want to change them. John Bell, the father, he was born in Halifax County, North Carolina, in 1750, and he was the son of William Bell and Anne Jones. In 1782, John Bell married Lucy Williams, and she was the daughter of a prominent farmer, John Williams. And the Bells bought a farm in Edgecombe County, and they seemed to flourish. They were happy. They were becoming prominent members of the community, and they were gaining wealth. But in 1804, John and Lucy and their children, Jesse, John Jr., Drury, Benjamin, Esther, Zadok, Elizabeth, Richard Williams, and Joel Egbert, built a house and started a farm located on the Red River in Robertson County, Tennessee. And that has since been renamed Adams, Tennessee. And yes, I did just name off a total of 9 children. So of their children, Benjamin died at a young age. Zadok became a prominent lawyer and moved to Mississippi, where he also died relatively young. Esther married Bennett Porter in 1817. Jesse married Martha Gunn, who is the daughter of Reverend Thomas Gunn, and he moved to Mississippi. John Bell Jr. married Elizabeth Gunn, who is also the daughter of Reverend Thomas Gunn, and became a successful farmer. Drury never married, and he owned a farm on the north side of the Red River. Elizabeth, who goes by Betsy, she eventually married, but I will discuss her situation a little later. Richard William Bell was married 3 times, first to Sally Gunn, yet another daughter of Reverend Thomas Gunn. Then he made his rounds over and got hitched to another Gunn girl, Susan Gunn. And then I guess he gave up on the Gunns, or maybe he ran out of Gunn girls, because he married a girl named Eliza Orndorff. He lived out his life in Robertson County. And the youngest child, Joel Egbert, married twice and moved to Springfield. So that's the family rundown. So, as I said, Bell purchased some land and a large house for his family, and over the next several years, he acquired 328 acres. He cleared a bunch of fields for planting. He became an elder at the Baptist Church. So they seemed to be doing very well. Until about 10 years later, and that's when shit really started happening. Let me tell you. It all started one day in 1817. John Bell was inspecting one of his fields when he came across a strange-looking animal sitting in one of the rows of his fields. So this was no ordinary animal. He didn't just stumble across a deer or a snake or a raccoon or something normal like that. No. This animal had the body of a dog and the head of a rabbit. So naturally, he pulled out his gun and started shooting. The animal disappeared. This was the first documented manifestation of the entity. But Bell thought nothing more of it and just kind of blew it off and went on with his day. But it didn't stop, because that very night, strange knocking sounds started outside the house on the exterior walls. The knocking continued, and it would dissipate when they would go out to see what it was. It was on the walls, the doors, the windows. Sometimes it sounded like it was coming from several places all at once. The mysterious sounds continued with increased frequency and force each night. Drury and Betsy also began seeing strange creatures near the property. Additional sounds, like the sounds of wings flapping against the ceiling, and more disturbingly, the sounds of choking and strangling, could be heard along with chains dragging and heavy objects hitting the floor. Sounds came from the bedroom as if beds were suddenly and roughly pulled apart. In addition, there were sounds of fighting dogs chained together, making the noise deafening. In all cases, the sources of the noises were never found. In the weeks that followed, the Bell children began waking up frightened, complaining that rats were gnawing at their bedposts. They would get up and look, expecting to find a rodent, or at the very least, marks on the bedpost where something was chewing. But nothing. And they would go back to bed. Then the noise started again. Again, they would look, but nothing. There were no holes or any other evidence of rats being in the house. Not long after that, the children began complaining of having their bed covers pulled from them and their pillows tossed onto the floor by a seemingly invisible entity. The gnawing continued, the chewing sounds continued, scratching, chains dragging across the floor. Then they realized it would answer them. If they asked it a question, it would answer in sounds and knocks. One night, John asked, "How many horses do we have?" And he got 12 distinct knocks as an answer. As time went on, the Bells began hearing faint whispering voices, which were too weak to understand, but sounded like a feeble old woman singing hymns. The encounters escalated, and the Bells' youngest daughter, Betsy Bell, began experiencing brutal encounters with the invisible entity. It would pull her hair, slap her relentlessly, often leaving welts and handprints on her face and her body. Lucy Bell, the mother, and John Jr., they were left relatively unharmed by the witch. Lucy was proclaimed by the witch to be the most perfect woman living, and the witch showed a great deal of compassion towards her, or so it seemed, and even cared for her and sang to her while she was ill. John Jr. had long, intense conversations with the witch. But don't be fooled that he liked her. He said her to be the spirit of the damned. So, I don't necessarily think that Lucy, the mother, and John were being treated differently or with special treatment or liked by the witch. Because if you stop and think about it, she was torturing and harming their loved ones. And I feel like maybe she was just playing to their weak spots. So one person may be physically weak, and so she's physically harming them. Whereas John Jr., who was in good physical condition, isn't going to be somebody that she messes with physically. Or even Lucy, the mother, who, I mean, my God, she had 9 children, and she was a hard worker and a strong woman. So maybe by tormenting her loved ones, it was in turn tormenting her. But who knows why she treated them differently. But you would think that emotionally, forcing them to watch the torment that she put on everyone around them is also traumatic and painful to them. So, let's get back to the story. Things were escalating. She was causing physical harm and just downright tormenting them. And this has been going on for about a year now. And John Sr. didn't necessarily want to tell anyone. You know, he was an elder at the church, and he was respected, and he had a reputation to uphold. So he wasn't too quick to start talking about, you know, these crazy things going on in his house. But the disturbances finally escalated to the point that he finally talked to one of his closest friends and a neighbor, James Johnston. So Johnston was skeptical at first, and him and his wife did agree to spend the night at the Bell's house. So I guess the night started off pretty peaceful, but once everyone retired for the evening, they were also subjects of the tormenting games by the Bell Witch. Their bed covers were yanked off, and James was slapped. And at this point, he jumps out of bed and he yells, "In the name of the Lord, who are you and what do you want?" The entity didn't respond to him, and the rest of the night was peaceful. So the next morning, Johnston explained to the Bells that he thought that the culprit was an evil spirit the kind that the Bible talks about, is what he said. And at first he thought that the disturbances were a practical joke being played by maybe the Bell children or somebody else in the community. But he changed his mind after spending that terrifying night in the Bell House. Now, James Johnson was a devout Christian, and it was said that he didn't really read and write well, but they considered him to be an expert on Christianity and the Bible. And because the Bible says that both good and bad spirits exist, and that trafficking with evil supernatural is possible, Johnston often expressed his belief that it was an evil spirit or a demon, just like in the Bible. And his sons also shared this belief. So the entity's voice strengthened over time and became loud and unmistakable. It sang hymns, it quoted scripture, it carried on intelligent conversations, and once it even quoted word for word two sermons that were preached at the same time on the same day, 13 miles apart. Word of the supernatural phenomenon soon started spreading outside of the area, even over to Nashville, where then Major General Andrew Jackson became interested in this so-called Bell Witch. In 1819, Jackson heard about the disturbances at the Bell House and decided to pay a visit and investigate himself. As Jackson's entourage, consisting of several men, horses, and a large wagon, approached the Bell property, the wagon jolted to a sudden stop. It had become stuck in a muddy creek bed, and the horses were unable to pull it. At least, that's what the men thought. After several minutes of cursing and trying to coax the horses into pulling the wagon, Jackson proclaimed, "By the eternal, boys, that must be the Bell Witch." Then, suddenly, a disembodied voice told Jackson that they could proceed and that she would see them again later that evening. They were then able to proceed across the property, up the lane, and to the Bell House. That evening, Jackson told old war stories while his entourage set up their tents in John and Lucy Bell's yard. One of Jackson's men claimed to be a witch tamer. After several hours went by, nothing was happening. He pulled out a shiny gun and said it had a silver bullet in it that would kill anything that came in contact with it. And he said the reason nothing was happening to them is because whatever had been haunting the Bells was scared of his silver bullet. So he's getting cocky, shooting his mouth off. And immediately, the man started screaming and he began jerking his body in different directions, complaining that he was being stuck with pins and beaten severely. A strong, swift kick to the man's posterior region, which means he got a kick in the ass, from an invisible foot sent him out the front door. Angry, the entity spoke up and announced that there was yet another fraud in Jackson's party and that she would identify him the following evening. Jackson's men were terrified and they started begging him to leave the Bell Farm. Jackson insisted on staying. He wanted to know who the other fraud was. The men eventually went outside to sleep in their tents, even though they just kept begging him to leave. Now, what happens next isn't really clear. It is said more things happened to them that evening. But what we do know is he was spotted, him and his entourage, the next morning going back to Nashville. So apparently they did not stay that extra night. And some say that Jackson later proclaimed, "I would rather fight the British at New Orleans than fight the Bell Witch." So, doesn't sound like a very fun night. Now, the family had a friend named William Porter, and he claimed that the witch climbed into bed with him, allowing him the opportunity to seize her. So this is his story. This is what he says about that night. One cold winter night, as he lay in bed, he felt the covers being pulled back and heard her familiar voice say that it had come to spend the night with him and keep him warm. Porter told the witch that if she was going to spend the night with him, she had to behave herself. He felt something sliding into bed with him and then felt the covers being pulled off of him as she rolled up in them and left him exposed. Porter said he suddenly realized that the form in the bed next to him was clearly outlined under the bed covers, so he had an idea. He grabbed the form, covers and all, and began carrying it towards the fireplace with the intention of throwing the whole thing in the fire. But the weight got heavier and heavier as he approached the fireplace, and what he described as an awful stench began rising from the covers. He had to drop the load and run from the house to get his breath, and she never again got into bed with him, or anyone else for that matter. The witch also seemed to dislike the family's slaves. She tormented them, she would beat them, and she refused to allow them in the house. A bell slave named Dean stated he encountered the witch several times and that it appeared frequently in the form of a large black dog or wolf, sometimes with two heads, sometimes with no head. Dean also claimed to be turned into a mule by her once, and she vowed that she was going to ride him to hell for breakfast. He claims that he was attacked several times by the witch and said that he had his head split by a large rabbit once. He would carry around something called a witch ball and an axe, and his wife is the one who made him this witch ball as protection from the witch. Now, he had a large scar on his head after this incident with the rabbit, but he said that it was the work of that old witch. It's believed that Dean and his wife are buried in two of the several unmarked slave graves on the property, or the Old Bell Cemetery near Adams. John Bell Sr. and Betsy Bell seem to be the two that were abused the most by the witch. The constant threat of the witch began to really affect Betsy so much that she became prone to fainting spells. She had smothering sensations. She was exhausted and lifeless. And her experiences didn't just stay on that property. Betsy later described this one incident. When the spirits became so tantalizing, filling my mind with horror and causing me to become so nervous, my parents often sent me to a neighbor's to rest for a night. My first night away from home was spent with Theeny Thorne. When we retired, there came a loud knocking on our outside door, which seemed to fly open, and a great gust of wind was felt. Theeny sprang up at once and lit a candle, but to our surprise, the door was not open. Then a voice spoke softly. "Betsy, you should not have come over here. You know I can follow you anywhere. Now get a good night's sleep." A soft hand patted my cheek, and the voice again assured us that we would not be disturbed anymore that night. The rest of the family often attempted to give Betsy relief, and family friend Frank Miles promised to protect Betsy from any further abuse by the spirit. Betsy said, "Frank was the most powerful man any of us ever saw, and just as fearless as any living man. One time he said to me, 'Come sit by me, little sister. Nothing will bother you while I'm here.' The witch responded, 'You go home. You can do no good here.' The witch then began abusing Betsy, slapping her, pulling her hair, before turning on Miles, knocking him over." Now, John Bell started experiencing episodes of twitching in his face, difficulty swallowing, pain that was like stabbing pain in his mouth. His jaw would lock closed. He was having seizures. And this was going on for almost a year, and it kept getting worse and worse. By the fall of 1820, His declining health really confined him to the house, where this malicious entity continuously removed his shoes when he tried to walk, slapped his face when he recovered from one of his seizures. Her shrill voice was heard all over the farm, cursing and chastising Old Jack Bell, the nickname that she had given him. John Bell breathed his last breath on the morning of December 20th, 1820, after slipping into a coma a day earlier. Immediately after his death, his family found a vial of strange, black, smoky liquid in the cupboard. It hadn't been there before, and it wasn't part of his normal medicines. Out of curiosity, John Jr. sprinkled 2 drops on their cat's tongue. The cat jumped up in the air, rolled over in midair, and was dead before it hit the floor. The spirit then exclaimed, "I gave old Jack a big dose of that last night, which fixed him." John Jr. tossed the vial into the fireplace, and it burst into bright blue flames and shot up the chimney. John Bell's funeral was one of the largest ever held in Robertson County, Tennessee. People came from miles away. 3 preachers gave eulogies. And as the crowd of mourners began leaving the graveyard, the Bell witch laughed and sang a song about a bottle of brandy. Her singing didn't stop until the last mourner left the graveyard. Now, the witch's presence was almost non-existent after John Bell's death, as though it had fulfilled its purpose. Almost, I said. It seemed like it had one more thing it wanted to take care of. Now, earlier I said that I was going to go into more detail about Betsy and her marriage. So let me just tell you how things played out for Betsy. Over time, Betsy Bell became interested in Joshua Gardner. He was a young man who lived nearby. With the blessings of their parents, they decided to marry. Everyone was happy about their engagements. Well, almost everyone. The evil, mysterious entity became furious and repeatedly ordered Betsy not to marry Joshua. The engagement did come to a sudden end on Easter 1821. Betsy and Joshua and several of their young friends from the area had gone fishing. It was a glorious day, and the banks of the Red River were full of fishermen enjoying the holiday and the sunshine. The enjoyment of the day was ruined, however, when a huge fish seized Joshua's line and jerked it, pole and all, into the river, leaping into the air, then diving to the bottom, carrying Joshua Gardner's fishing pole with it. Those who saw it said the fish was between 2 and 3 feet long. Almost no one thought it was an ordinary fish, especially when it returned a short time later, swimming along the surface, still dragging the fishing pole behind it. Then came a familiar voice, as if from thin air, and repeating over and over in a horrible voice filled with gloom, "Please, Betsy Bell, don't have Joshua Gardner." When the voice died away, Betsy Bell removed the engagement ring from her finger and gave it back to Joshua Gardner, convinced at last that the witch would never leave them in peace. Gardner apparently knew this too. He accepted the return of the ring, and a short time later he moved away from Robertson County. He and Elizabeth never saw each other again. Now, Betsy and Joshua's former school teacher, Professor Richard Powell, had been noticeably interested in Betsy for some time and had expressed interest in marrying her when she became older. So, think about that for a second. The teacher digging on his student, just waiting for her to come of age. That's kind of fucking creepy, right? By some accounts, Powell, who was 11 years older than Betsy, was a student of the occult. He was also well-versed in horticulture and geology. And, I don't know, a mathematical genius. So maybe a smart guy. But he was also secretly married to a woman in nearby Nashville, Esther Scott, during the time that he lived and taught school at Red River. And so he was perceived as a happy-go-lucky bachelor and expressed his fondness for Betsy, all while being secretly married to another woman. So, and it was kind of open that he was disappointed in Betsy's engagement to Joshua. But after Joshua and Betsy broke up, he got his way. He got Betsy, and they did eventually marry. Now, in April of 1821, a little bit after Betsy broke off her engagement with Joshua, the entity did visit Lucy and told her it was leaving, but it would return in 7 years. And she did. The entity returned in 1828 as promised. Most of the return centered around John Bell Jr., where the spirit and John Jr. would discuss the origin of life, civilization, Christianity, and the need for a major spiritual reawakening. Of particular significance were its prediction of the Civil War and other major events, some of which she missed. The entity left 3 weeks later, promising to visit John Bell's most direct descendant in 107 years. That would put it the year 1935. And the closest living direct descendant at the time was Nashville physician Dr. Charles Bailey Bell, a neurologist, and John Bell Sr.'s great-grandson. In 1934, Dr. Bell published a book about the Bell Witch, likely to raise awareness of the spirit's impending return. The book contains the first ever account of the alleged conferences between the entity and John Bell Jr. in 1828. The author's father, Dr. Joel Thomas Bell, had allegedly taken notes during the conferences and upon his death passed them down to him, Dr. Charles. And Dr. Charles Bell published no follow-up to his 1934 book, and he died in 1945. And he is buried at Bellwood Cemetery in Adams, Tennessee. So, did the Bell Witch return in 1935 as promised? Some say she did not return, or that if she did, they were not aware of it. But many say she never left the place to begin with. The faint sounds of people talking, children playing, can all sometimes be heard in the area. And it's not uncommon to see candle lights dancing through the dark fields late at night. Photography is especially difficult. Some pictures taken in the area show mists, orbs, and other phenomena, including human-like figures who were not present when the picture was taken. Could all this be related to the haunting of John Bell's family? Well, let me tell you about someone by the name of Mary Catherine Batts. She went by Kate Batts, and she was the wife of Frederick Batts, and she was believed by many to be the culprit behind these disturbances known as the Bell Witch. Although not a poor woman, she was often mocked by others throughout the Red River settlement in Robertson County. Her improper usage of words, along with her sometimes strange ways, led many to think she was practicing black magic or other forms of the occult. Now, genealogy information from North Carolina, along with the census and other information in Tennessee, strongly suggest that Mrs. Batts was the niece of Lucy Bell. More specifically, she was the daughter of John Williams Jr., which was Lucy William Bell's brother. And there was said to be a fight over land between John Bell and Kate Batts, and that Batts was getting revenge on him. While there are plenty of stories connecting the Bell Witch to Kate Batts, and some sort of disagreement that did exist between her and John Bell, recent evidence actually suggests that she had nothing to do with it. In fact, contrary to reports of her claiming that she would get even with John Bell on her deathbed, Kate Batts actually lived longer than John Bell by many years. Today, there are many descendants of the Batts family living in Cheatham, Montgomery, and Robertson County. Now, a few rational explanations of the Bell Witch have been offered over the years. The haunting, they say, was a hoax perpetuated by Richard Powell, the schoolteacher of Betsy Bell, the one who was digging on her and was not liking the fact that she was engaged to Joshua. So he was deeply in love with her and would do anything to destroy her relationship with Joshua Gardner. Through a variety of pranks, tricks, and with the help of several accomplices, it is theorized that Powell created all of the effects of the ghost to scare Gardner away. Indeed, Gardner was the target of much of the witch's violent taunting, and he eventually did break up with Betsy and left the area. It has never been fully explained or understood how Powell achieved all of these remarkable effects, including paralyzing Andrew Jackson's wagon. But he did come out the winner, didn't he? He ended up getting the girl and marrying Betsy Bell. Many believe Betsy was cursed, and this seems to be confirmed by a life full of grief and tragedy. In addition to losing four children at young ages, her husband became an invalid after suffering a stroke. Following her husband's death in 1848, Betsy Bell moved from Tennessee to Yalabusha County, Mississippi. In 1888, she passed away and was buried in the remotely located Long Branch Cemetery near Water Valley, where she remains to this day. However, the story of the Bell Witch doesn't end with Betsy. John T. Bell, the grandson of John Bell, and his family were allegedly tormented by the Bell Witch in Panola and Yalabusha counties. According to the legend, John T. Bell's daughter, Mary, fell in love with an overseer named Gerald. Completely against the love affair, John T. Bell killed Gerald. Not long after, Mary became extremely ill and constantly spoke of Gerald before falling into a state of unconsciousness. Several days later, she awoke, proclaimed she was going to be with Gerald, and died. On the way to Mary's funeral, a large, dark bird flew circles around the carriage, carrying the casket. As the story goes, the bird stayed until the last piece of dirt was put on the casket. But that's not all. According to local lore, there has been a lot of strange happenings in Panola and Yalabusha counties over the years. The occurrences include blood coming out of faucets, strange lights in woods at night, and people hearing their names called when in the woods. Now, there is a cave near the property of the Bell home. Several incidents occurred near the northwest corner of the Bell Farm, and the cave incident involved a little boy who accidentally got his head stuck between two rocks. After the boy had yelled for some time, the entire cave lit up and invisible hands tugged at his legs. His head was freed, and he was pulled all the way back to the cave entrance. Was it the Bell Witch? There's other history associated with the cave as well, and it is registered a historical site now, and you can actually visit the cave. The house is no longer there. They do say that she hangs out at that cave, and she still messes around with people, that her spirit is still there. So you can visit, if you dare. So that is a story of the Bell Witch. What do you think, guys? Kind of a creepy one, right? Gives you a little bit of chills. Lots of stuff that went on there. Yeah, she really messed with him, didn't she? Again, you know, no proof. It's just one of those spooky stories. And, you know, but a lot of people witnessed things that happened and heard things. And it's not like it was just one person with some stories. There were several people that witnessed things. And so, like I said, one of the most documented American hauntings ever. Definitely creepy. So again, thank you for listening to that story. Thank you for joining me on yet another Follow Me Into the Dark. I'm glad that you guys are enjoying these. Thank you for all the support. And of course, you can click on the links in the description to my Instagram and Facebook pages, and also my contact information. And, you know, that's it, guys. That's the end of the story. I don't have any more for you. So I will catch you guys next week. Don't worry. I am not going to be in Vegas again for a while. So I should be back to 100% next week. Again, I apologize that I am a day late. Please forgive me. And until next week, stay dark, my friends.